So I guess the first thing we wanted to do was have each of the groups report back, and I understand that each group is appointed or drafted or selected or randomly or by some process someone who's going to do that. So there are both obviously comments from this morning and this afternoon to kind of get on the record. Michelle tells me she and Hillary are going to have a type-off in terms of taking notes, so we're going to have an excellent record of the kinds of suggestions that pop forward. So I'm just going to call the groups, and I'm not quite sure who's speaking for them. I'm told Amanda Bittner was number one group, and who is speaking for that group, reporting from that group? Group one? Deborah is. So the timing was perfect. We're going to give her a count of three to catch her breath. We're going to then turn on microphone three. The whole hall's watching you, Deborah.
I know. So which one first? Okay. So this is, what did we learn from the public hearings? That's the one you want? Okay. There are concerns that the referendum 60% will be hard to attain. We also found that both local representation and proportionality were discussed as quite important and could very well be reflective of regional differences. They've told us that they want all the votes to count and more voter choice. Both of these would make our systems much fairer than they are now. Change is wanted in the way our government operates, and hopefully we can attain this through electoral reform. At every hearing, the people express their appreciation for our work on the Assembly and trust that we will come up with an acceptable plan. People want more accountability. People would like less party control over our MLAs. And the people would like a less adversarial government that provides clear, concise communication.
That's it. Are they happy with one Christmas a year?
We could have one in July.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like that here in Prince George anyway, isn't it? Did you want to say something about maybe what the group said this afternoon? Just maybe go through it, and then we'll go on to the next groups. That might be more efficient.
How can the submissions help your decision? We found the charts and summaries completed by Campbell very helpful. We finally agreed that the Assembly should be divided into groups of approximately 10. Each group would be assigned approximately 20 submissions to read. By doing this, we would be able to get through them all without further taxing the Assembly staff. These submissions would be read at our leisure and discussed within group. This would be one more step in our self-education with the information gathered, processed along with what we have heard at hearings and from people in our communities.
Summer reading on the beach, I love it. I predicted this, didn't I, some months ago. That's terrific. Thanks, Deborah, very much. Group two, I'm not sure who's speaking for group two. Oh, microphone 13, Tanya is going to report.
I'll read the morning one first for what did we learn from the public hearings. For the first question we had posed to us was what general impressions did you get from the hearings and the presenters? One thing we said was fairness. The fairness, or it needs to change, we need more fairness, often had MMP presented. We also thought that maybe the views presented may not be reflective of BC as a whole or, representative of the BC people that didn't get a chance to speak. And some of the views didn't reflect what we thought in the discussion group. For the second question, which was what did Ken miss, we thought maybe one of the things that you missed was the none of the above vote. We thought that that was pretty talked about a lot in a lot of the presentations. Whether it relates to us in our mandate, is we're not sure. But another thing we thought you missed was the party discipline and the frustration people feel with that. A fixed election date, whether it's liked or disliked. And we also thought that you missed the point maybe where people suggested we should have more women, First Nations, and minority groups in the legislature. For the third question, which was what values did we hear from the public hearings, honesty, an anti-wasted vote, or you want to be able to say that your vote counted or didn't waste. Local representative was important. Sorry, I'm just reading off of someone else's notes here. I'll go on to the fourth question. It was if there were any differences by the region, by regional issues. The North lacks the population for effective representation, party line concerns, and no PR was presented. And the fifth question was things that were off topic from the mandate but maybe are worth noting. We need a record of all the voices, party discipline, women in First Nations and minority involvement in government, post-election evaluation, how it's going to work and who's going to say if it's not working or how long it's going to be before we decide to maybe change it again. Improve party governance, remove, I'm not sure, this is Cameron's writing, so I can't really read it. But that was all I had for the first, for the morning session.
It sounds like your group did a lot of good work. How did you do this afternoon?
Well, we, for what are the submissions saying to us, we came up with actual just kind of some ideas that we liked and things that we thought we should do. Maybe what we could do is group some of the submissions by category and then highlight four or five or six that we thought were had some good ideas but were pretty representative of some of the others in that same category. We also thought it would be interesting to know who's writing the submissions, if it's available, you know, maybe what they do for a living or if they're related to any political organization or anything like that. If the person with that wrote the submission made a presentation and where. On the final report, the Citizens Assembly should confirm the final report, as in to say, you know, we agree with it, not end in the end of November and then have it written afterwards. So we're, you know, we were concerned that it will be written without our approval. We could delegate submissions to be read by members. Then the members could recommend a few that they figured that they believed were worthy of, you know, being shared with the rest of the group. And we also thought it was important to say that the submissions are only one way of making a final decision, and that, you know, we're all 160 people here and we all have our own minds and ideas and opinions and thoughts, and those are important as well. We've received a lot of submissions. In our group, we kind of had 50% of the people thinking that, you know, maybe a poll would be a good idea, and the other half thought that there was really no need for a poll. We thought that maybe on the website, on the Assembly's members' website, we could put a category of favorite submissions, and members could just post that submission number there to say that they liked it. We also wanted to note that members have a responsibility to read as many of the submissions as possible, you know, assuming time constraints, but we just want to make sure that, you know, you're not looking at the first 20 or 30 because they may not be representative of what all of the submissions are saying. And some of the members in our group also thought that the submissions weren't reflective of the population views. No offense to Campbell, but they were chosen for their content, you know, which is necessary, but may not have been representative of all the submissions. And that's all we had.
Gosh, that's a lot. Thanks. That was terrific.
Thank you.
RB. What number is your mic?
Nine. Yes, first of all, our group, we talk about the presentations from you and Campbell, and we all thank you all, thank both of you, and congratulations, it was a job well done. And whatever you have done have been extremely helpful. Now, on the public hearings, We try to identify what the general values that we heard most. And we have listed them, and some of them had come up in the earlier presentations. So I will not repeat them. But I might repeat here one or two, so excuse me for that. Like, for an example, less control over the MLAs by the government. And stability in terms of policies as well as in terms of government. And accountability, of course, and simplicity to make everything plain, simple, and understandable, and so that it can be easily understood by the public when we go to a referendum in the event we go ahead and decide a change, and no to adversarial policies, and voter choice. Basically, what we are saying is to vote for. What we heard was we want to vote for somebody, not against someone on a strategic basis. And of course, we also heard something that should turn around the voter turnout. We also discuss as a group regional differences, what we heard. We discuss about the local representation in rural areas and the significance to geography and the connections or the access to the MLAs in those districts in the north and in urban areas. In that discussion, we also looked at the MMP, what we heard about the MMP. We heard in many places it's trying to get the best of both the worlds. And it's a system that helps to have more women and minorities represented. And to build, to make decisions on consensus. So some members also felt that they heard enough that MMPs also could help the voter turnout apathy problem. And one member raised the issue that, proportional representation in the first place may be coming from those, you know, small parties on self-interest. So, but there were different views on that issue. So that's about what we heard. And then about what we got as written presentations from Campbell's presentation on that. We discussed three basic areas, ranking versus sorting, especially where Campbell can help us more for us to understand all the presentations given in writing. As you know, we may not have the time to read every one of them and to come to a point to say, well, now we have read all the written presentations on the present system as well as the presentation recommending change. So in that regard, we thought it may be advantageous for the members if Campbell, and perhaps with the help of Ken too, to go for further sorting out of these two groups, especially, I mean the group talking about the present system and the group talking about change. We got into a heated, very interesting debate on ranking versus sorting. So what we really are looking for is some kind of sorting, not ranking, so that the members decide what is good for them. Of course, the workload of Campbell himself, we felt there should be a solution, and Jack and the staff would look into that. Now, we also looked at what we would like to see in Campbell's indexes or the indexing of the presentations, length, the real-world examples in different scenarios, population-oriented evidence that matters. We also talk about redundancy issues and duplicate submissions, categorizations, as the earlier person member spoke about, and source from where it's coming, and to avoid repetition We also heard from Campbell that the same person submitting, the same kind of thing in different names. So the last thing that we discussed at length was this submission deadline. So we would, of course, thought that if we can advance the deadline from August 13th or 14th to 1st of August and give us this index and everything else as much before than what we are now thinking, it would be very helpful to the members. And the second point was a fundamental question. Should we have a deadline to stop all the public hearings on that day, or that this is only a deadline to facilitate the process for us to go ahead with our deliberation? So we thought, well, we can inform the public that this date, if any submissions coming after this date, may not be able to be considered, but leaving room for anyone else to come even after that. So, for an example, even during the time of presentation, maybe on the 14th of December, there are some presentation which is very critical, then Campbell can keep on keeping track of this and come and say, raise a flag and say, hey guys, there's something important like this. So it was very interesting and very, very interesting debate. Thank you.
Thank you, RB. I should tell you that I promised Campbell that he could have the weekends off in July. But your suggestions are all very helpful, and well, I'll give him something to do. Group 4, who's speaking for Group 4? Mike 25, is that you, Chuck?
Hi. We had a fairly good discussion. In the defining the key messages on the this morning's thing, we had a bunch of concerns about things like the post recommendation, if there's any change. We also discussed who owns our message and the limitation of our mandate. And also we talked about the representativeness of views within the hearing process and the public mood over change. And also we went into a fairly lengthy discussion about the disagreement in the deliberation phase that's ahead of us. And our impressions of hearings, a proportionality, in our impression of hearings, we talked about proportionality, riding size, a simple ballot, a PR-like system, and again we discussed local representation as becoming a sticking point in our deliberation. We talked about mixed and PR systems that reduce party control and giving smaller parties a chance to get elected. And then this afternoon we talked about hard copy for non-computer users, prioritized by systems, details like the number of supporters that in any particular system or submission. And we also discussed how awkward it is to visualize so many submissions being able to give us an answer. And a suggestion was made that by maybe 5 presentations or 5 submissions be made as presentations to the assembly from the list. We also talked about having access to computers. And then in discussing these submissions, we talked about using a discussion forum like we do with other things. And assembly should recommend some submissions as reference material. And we also wanted to take note of the trends that the submissions tended to lead us to.
Thanks very much, Chuck. Group 5, who's reporting for Group 5? Sheila, I think, and microphone number 28.
Our facilitator was Kashi. He kept us on track most of the time. He tried really hard. Our facilitator was Kashi. He worked really hard at keeping us on track, and mostly he was very successful. So our first question was, what did we learn from the public hearings? And we spoke to the key messages that were on mandate. And those messages were accountability. Most people were asking for change and speaking to the need for change. Fairness was mentioned a lot. We heard that people were asking for something that was going to be a simple thing for the electorate, but we also heard that people didn't want us to underestimate what voters were able to handle as well. We heard that votes should more equal the seats that are in the legislature. We heard a fair amount of confusion or questions around open and closed lists. A frequent theme was proportional representation with a local representative and most often MMP or STB. We heard a call for requesting more diversity, a lot of negative things around adversarial politics, and a lot of positive things around consensual politics. The key messages that were off our mandate, there was apparently a really strong opinion that we should no longer have a queen. There was a lot of discussion around ways to increase voter turnout, including getting paid to vote, getting tax deductions for voting, getting food, and a suggestion that if you were given a voucher when you exercised your right to vote, which then gave you the right to complain to your MLA afterwards. We went on to discuss other things after that because we finished a little early this morning in some respects. We talked about the none of the above that hadn't been mentioned in our discussions this morning. There had been suggestions that there should be a 60% requirement to overturn a recommendation. If we went to referendum and there was a change, then there also should be a 60% vote required to overturn that change down the road. We'd heard that people were asking for limiting terms of office. They were asking for candidate selection reform, and there were also some suggestions that politicians should be chosen by lot. For this afternoon, under what the submissions were saying to us, we felt that the submissions were covering a large range of values. We noticed with the submissions on the web that some of the partisan stuff that we didn't hear at the hearings was not vetted for us on the web, and I guess that it's not they're not those submissions aren't vetted, and that felt uncomfortable. We noticed that they're mostly all asking for change, either MMP, New Zealand is mentioned a lot. With not really specific direction as to what people might want to see with an MMP system, whereas we noticed that the STV systems that people have suggested are mostly very detailed oriented, with suggestions that represents more of a radical change than the MMP. And we felt that people had very strong personal attachments to the suggestions that they were making on the web. And we had a question, when people are making submissions that perhaps were originally designed as a change for Canada, would those submissions that were to be submitted as Canada changes, would they actually translate over to BC changes as well? For the question of what we needed to learn, we felt that it would be better if we had a bit more of an idea of the values of the people making submissions on the web, and we would like to know more about who was making... We would like to know more about the people that were making those suggestions and what their opinions were or what their background was. Should the number of submissions for a particular system give it more weight? We thought that perhaps the high knowledge of MMP systems seemed to... It made it comparatively hard to measure the opinions that people might have had on other electoral systems, and we were wondering if we were missing opinions from people. There's an analogy that I was told when my first baby arrived, and it was to listen to everybody's opinions, put them all together, and go with what your heart said. And we felt that that was perhaps a good way of dealing with all of these submissions and information, if we took our education and then all of the opinions and let that sort of come to a feeling in our heart, that we thought that that was a way to deal with so many different ideas. We wondered how to deal with diametrically opposed opinions, for example, opinions that might represent a rural area as opposed to an urban area, knowing that we couldn't please everyone, but not wanting to exclude important smaller vote areas. We also spent time after that discussing what the process might be if there was a recommendation for change, what the process would be for after that to promote the referendum.
Thanks, Sheila. Group 6, who's speaking for Group 6?
With regards to this morning and what we learned from the public hearings, number one, the differences, the regional differences in expressed concerns. Local representation seemed to be more important in the rural areas. However, when pressed, the public basically said that effective representation was the most important issue to them. Other important issues heard from the public, there was a fair amount of concern. We heard a fair amount of concern regarding the restrictions of the mandate, i.e. that the number of seats effectively were not to be touched, or the party domination and the various rules and so on. There was also concerns expressed about the fact that the parameters of the possible referendum with 60% in 50% of the ridings was overly restrictive. And there were also a number of concerns expressed with regards to what is going to happen after December the 15th should we recommend a change. With regard to Ken's report, generally Ken's report reflected what we heard, but we didn't feel that the public hearings in general, that the public hearings were representative of BC. For example, the hearings were dominated by people expressing a wish for an MMP or proportional system, and we don't believe that that's really what all of British Columbia necessarily wanted. We also don't feel that there's adequate coverage given in your report to those supporting no change to the present electoral system or those expressing resistance to an increase in the size of the ridings. With regard to the process itself of the public hearings, we felt that the deluge from one apparent party or group could possibly have been weeded out prior to the hearings. In this afternoon's sessions, what did the submission say to us? We broke that one down, suggested process and information. We feel that we'd like to have the ability to attach comments and or rank individual submissions and to have this possibility visible only on the members' website. So to have some method, a star method or whatever, of ranking, plus to be able to make comment. And in other words, that the public would see, the general public would see just the submissions, but we would be able to have an ongoing sort of discussion there. We'd also like to see, and this is a further to Chuck's suggestion, we'd like to see a member selection group set up to pick, or the suggestion was made, a member selection group to pick top online submissions and to mail hard copies of those submissions to those without internet access so that they have it now rather than at some point down the road. And that was sort of in support of the idea of what Wilf was saying, that, you know, they're kind of, for us having internet access, we're, it's dynamic for us, it's ongoing, but they're kind of left out. We wanted to have submissions identified which have supporting information. We wanted to also know which submissions were publicly submitted at hearings, and we certainly support the idea of the staff setting up a cumulative spreadsheet which records the members' top selections. With regards to the values that we felt that had been identified so far in submissions, We feel that people are saying they want their voices heard and they want to be more effectively represented. People seem to want their MLA to be responsible to the voters and not to the party. They want their vote to count. They want less adversarial and more consensual politics. They want changes that go beyond our mandate with regard to the electoral system. And we got a feeling of a sense of hopefulness from people, which we really were encouraged by. And we have a question for you with regards to our members' website, and that is the discussion that takes place on the members' website subject to the Freedom of Information and Protection Act?
Thank you, Julie. Group 7. Derek?
Derek, yep.
Derek and Mike 24.
Hello. Hi. To start off with this morning in terms of the public hearings, we had very passionate calls from local representation, knowledgeable local and accountable representation, specifically in the north. It was identified as very important the further north that one got in the province. And that's not to say there weren't calls for local representation as a priority in the lower mainland, but those calls were made in regards to the north. It's interesting. People definitely had more of a provincial vision rather than a parochial vision, which was nice. There was a definite concern that our legislatures do not reflect the political culture of the province, both at the provincial level and the federal level. And this was referenced to the leaders' debates that were recently televised on the CBC federally. And it's outside of our mandate, but we can definitely take heed in terms of what our political system can impart towards our culture and how we interact. Basic sense is that what we have now is not an accurate reflection. There was, I think it's hard to underestimate the massive amount of cynicism and discontent there was with politics in general and society in general, really, in terms of political parties. And the concern with that is it's accompanied with a massive desire for change. There is a huge amount of hope and pressure, and a lot of people put a lot of eggs in our basket in terms of what they're expecting to get out of this. There's a lot of desire for a wholesale social change to come out, and personally, I don't feel that we can do it. And I remember we were cautioned by a Muslim McClay when back in Vancouver that not that much will necessarily change. We're the same people, we've got the same opinions, and I think we need to be more careful in cautioning. It's too late now, but cautioning people so eager to see us save the province that we can only do so much. In terms of the submissions, we had several suggestions about how to probably access them, and one of them is exactly identical to the one that was mentioned in the first group, which was to assign submissions in chunks to random groups of members to rate for others. And I suspect some collaboration there, because it was identical. For those without web access, there wasn't too much concern. Those who, instead of we all have the abstracts handed out to us at the meetings, and while they aren't an accurate description necessarily, they're good enough that you can pick out the ones you want to read more about and ask for print copies. In terms of values that came out of the submissions, they were very similar to what came out of the public hearings. Fairness, desire for change, basically a brand new world that we can hope to provide. And if I could add personally, we need to remember to take the submissions for what they're worth as a valuable resource, but not necessarily our sole focus. There's a lot of effort being put today into how can we possibly synthesize 1,000 submissions into our final. We can't do that, and if we don't do that, we haven't failed.
Thanks, Derek. Group 8.
Okay, what did we learn from the public hearings? We felt that the people were saying the current system needs to be changed, and the public support for proportionality is high, but they're unclear on the details. Public also want to see a successful referendum. The public also expressed concern about the limitations of our mandate, and a large number of the public still are unaware of the Citizens Assembly or what we're up to, and that the special interest presenters seem to dominate the public hearings. Topics that seemed to be off mandate kept coming up were the voting age to be reduced, more free votes with less party discipline, regulation of parties, and campaign financing. And this afternoon for the submissions, some sort of regional sorting, a breakdown where they are from, a system breakdown, how many and why, and that the content of the submission is more important than the number. And in the newsletter, there could be some plugs for some good submissions for the members.
Good, thanks, Lee. I should tell the people here, if you don't know, that Lee sacrificed a Sunday morning during the public hearing phase by going fishing in the Charlottes and caught a big fish. Group 9?
Terry was our facilitator. What did we learn from the public hearings? Well, we learned that having written submissions ahead of the presenter's presentation would have been helpful to the members. In the future, we would have been able to look at what was coming and anticipate some questions we may have liked to ask of the presenters. We also learned that there seemed to be some concern that the 60% threshold may mean that the assembly was set up to fail in any recommendation it would make. You know, the odds would be stacked against us right from the start. We learned that a public education strategy might be helpful. We were wondering, you know, if a recommendation for change is made, who will champion that to get the word out to the public and inform them so they can make the right decision? Overall, though, from a big picture point of view, our group felt that probably we have received sufficient input from the public to go ahead to the deliberation phase at this point. We were wondering what other kinds of information we might like to get from a poll of average British Columbians. And then we realized, well, we have an assembly of 160 average British Columbians here from all ages, all walks of life, from all ridings. So it's probably already pretty representative to begin with, you know, and we all had our opinions and biases when we started, but now we've had some education and we're able to move on and make some informed recommendations. So, you know, as long as we as an assembly can put our hand over our heart and say we've exercised due diligence to get the message out and find as much information as we can, we probably can go ahead. You know, we've got almost 1,000 submissions and we've had 50 public hearings, so that is pretty good in that regard. The one area, though, where we acknowledge that we could be a little weak is our group was not really ready to speak about some of the regional differences, you know, especially between urban and rural areas. We felt that perhaps other assembly members, either from those areas or the ones who had attended the public hearings in those areas, could provide a little more amplification on some of the issues and concerns that are faced, you know, in rural ridings. And that's all.
Great. Thanks, Darren. And Group 10.
Pretty much everybody's covered everything we've got written down here, but we'll go through it quickly. Not hearing from everyone, a broad representation lacking in our public meetings. 60% to pass a referendum, we felt a little bit high. Pretty much everywhere we went, change was wanted, and we found that PR was mentioned the most. Public did not feel well informed about alternate electoral systems. Local representation important, but people are willing to compromise somewhat to accommodate a change. Accountability by government is important. Local MLAs more accountable to party than to constituents. Assumption that House could be increased to change to MMP. That was from our public hearings. Suggestions to Campbell.
It was felt that if we could see a few more graphs, charts, and spreadsheets to see our list a little more categorized, identifying duplicates, geographical origin of submissions, rating of submissions for members only on our website, have members submit top five picks, and members take responsibility for reading a minimum number of submissions, coordinate so every report has been read. One thing that was mentioned there that, for an example, everyone picked up their tent card at the next meeting and would be assigned so many to read. And what group or interest group a submission represents. And as far as our topics off of mandate, I think Lee's group there was just about word for word for ours.
Great. Thanks, Bob. We've got a few minutes, so I want to open it up so others can jump in if they'd like to. There were two things that came up. I just want to say one or two things about, hopefully to help clarify. The first was a concern that the report might be written after the Assembly had made the decisions and was not there to approve it. Not a chance. You people are going to take the rap for this report, not the night owls that write it, and certainly it will in full text come, and you know, if you're there all night like the legislature is sometimes, we get the wording right. It's your report, and it's really important that that happen. Let me say one thing about the 60-60, because I think two or three groups raised it. The first thing I guess I would say is it's the law, and we probably ought to just kind of get on with it and accept it. And I say that partly because from the very beginning we knew that was the process. I think it was mentioned in most of the selection meetings. You may not remember it, but there was some talk about that was the kind of framework by which the Assembly had been set up. So it's not new. But we want to think about it clearly because it's not a requirement to pass. It's a requirement on the government. The 60-60 requirement requires the government to introduce it in the legislature whether it likes it or not, if it passes by that mandate. If it passes by any other requirement, the government may also introduce it and pass it or not in the legislature. All the 60-60 thing says is if it passes by 60% of the vote and in 60% of the districts, the government must bring it to the legislature. So it's not an obligation of a... you can see it as a standard of pass, but it's a kind of standard on the government to behave if the voters in those numbers say that that's what they want. I guess my own view is I've always read that as a kind of, in some sense, a political statement by which the government says, look, we're not going to let one area of the province, and we can guess which one that might be, ram something down the throats of the rest of the provinces. And so this is a kind of measure of relatively widespread support for some kind of a change. That's what they're trying to signal, I think. It's probably also worth remembering that we had two other referendums on electoral issues about 10 years ago. I think it was in 1991, that election, to provide for recall and to provide for initiative. Both those were referendum campaigns. They weren't vigorously fought, but they both passed by about 80% quite easily. I think if there's a popular, well-thought-out proposal, and I'm not sure either of those were all that well-thought-out, that gets the support of the public, the legislature will introduce it. Because I don't think anybody in the legislature was keen on recall. There's not a politician elected who wants to be recalled. Yet it was passed, and they said, oh, well, okay, we're going to have to pass a recall bill. It took them a couple of years to do it, but they did it, and the same with initiative. So I guess my own view would be that it would be easy to get hung up on this. We ought to remember it's an obligation on the government, not something else. And that if the Assembly produces a good report that's clear, that has widespread support in the Assembly and in the public, in any kind of decent democratic society, it will be adopted. If it produces a bad report that's confused and contradictory and doesn't have much support, it will probably get what one would expect. So I don't want to preach about this, but I think we don't want to get overly preoccupied with something like this that is the law and that is in some sense part of the framework that established the mandate. We also had the question of the submission deadline And maybe at the end of this session we can come back to that and we can either have a straw vote or some kind of formal process, or we could even do it tomorrow morning, so that Campbell will know how many weekends he has to work and what a kind of cutoff date for getting materials to you would be reasonable. We had a suggestion to kind of even advance it out of one of the groups, but we'll come to that. But we do have a number of minutes before Leo tells us about the rest of the province, and the rest being not the Lower Mainland. So let's open the floor for anyone who wants to jump in. Shoni. Microphone 5.
Ken, I was wondering what the surveys that were handed out to audience members at the public meetings showed.
They're still being compiled.
Okay.
You know, with most of the staff on the road doing the hearings, some of them are in the set, but we're still gathering them. And when we get them all finalized, they'll be in a newsletter or a kind of report that'll go to members for sure. Craig, and you're at microphone 17.
Yeah, I've got a worry that we're all going to start in at the submissions and start reading them at number one, and we'll all read 20 of them. So 160 of us will read the same ones over and over and over, and the last ones will never get read except by three or four people. And maybe one way to avoid doing that is if we take our last initial and sort them by last name, and if we start at our last initial, I would start with H, those submissions, and go through, well, let's say to Z, and then all the way back around to A, and go a circle like that. Then at least we'd have people from the assembly reading all the different submissions. And if, just out of rough math, if we read 100 each, that means that 16 people would read each submission. And so the ideas in those submissions wouldn't be lost. But I worry that the last quarter of those submissions will be overlooked because everyone starts at the beginning.
Your suggestion is that everybody sort them alphabetically by the person who wrote them and then start with the one that matches the same letter of the alphabet. That's an interesting way of doing it without having to have a kind of complicated process. Microphone 30, back in the corner.
Like, I can tell you right now, there's no way I'm going to read 700 submissions. Absolutely no way. What we suggested is that we divide us into maybe 10 groups, and we divide the submissions amongst the 10 groups so that each individual would have to read maybe 5 to 10 submissions. And I think we could all do a good job on that. But I would suggest to you, don't come to me and say that you expect me to read 100 submissions complete and be able to understand them and discuss them afterwards. I could do that with 5 or 10, but I couldn't do it with 100.
Well, I think you could, Chris. You're pretty smart. Somebody else want to jump in? Yes, Tanis, 13. Is this a Friday the 13th kind of?
I was in Chris's group, and we certainly had some pretty lively debate about how to tackle the submissions. And for me, it comes down to responsibility and commitment. And that's just, you know, you guys, the province of British Columbia has invested in me, and so I can invest back into the process, and at least I would like to see the Assembly make a commitment that all of those submissions are going to be read, because, let's face it, people put them on the website in order to be read by somebody, ideally a member of the Assembly. And so I really think that that we need to commit to getting them all read, whether it's all 700 by each person, 100 or 10, which would be more manageable.
Well, I guess Tanis could read 500 and everybody else could read one. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on a very important head, Tanis. Gene. And Gene's at 23.
I just wanted to reiterate what Tanis just said to groups. We told those people the two of us are going to read every submission, and we've done that. And I think others here have done the same thing. So I encourage you to. It's not hard. Half of them are one paragraph. So go ahead and get on with it, folks. Thank you.
If you read the little blurbs, it's easy to figure out which ones are redundant. And if we could find out exactly which ones were on actual presentations, we wouldn't have to read those ones, right? Because we've already... That's a different kind of thing.
Yeah, thanks, Amanda. And I should say that the abstracts that you've just been talking about were all written by Campbell, so you know that they are impartial, clear, focused, and give you a very quick 250-word max, I think, because that's all he's allowed in this space. 250 characters. So they are brief, as you say. They do represent a kind of consistent way of writing and providing an account for that, so they do provide quite a good guide. Peter, you were at mic 15? 16.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that about hard copies. I was on a flight from Vancouver to Prince George last night and had the privilege to sit by a lady called Sylvia, and she's Métis, and she lives out here in Prince George. We started to talk, and Sylvia... she asked what I was doing, and that I was coming here to Prince George, and that was part of the Citizens' Assembly. And she had no idea what, she never heard anything about this or what was going on or the meeting. She heard nothing in the media. And she asked me this question, and she figured this was a wonderful and interesting thing that we're doing. But how are these local isolated First Nation, Métis, non-status, Aboriginal people and others getting informed? And how can they get access if they don't know anything about us? So on behalf of Sylvia, I just wanted to ask that for these local communities isolated that have no access to web or mail and is just their part of life.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you.
Good point. RB, and RB is at microphone number 9.
I want to go back to the need to read the presentations by all the members. I think there's no shortcut to this. This is what we have come. I mean, this is what we have to do as members. I think, in a sense, it's essential to read all the presentations that have gone into the website. So there's no shortcut to this, fellow members. I think we have to see how we can do this best. In practical terms, yes, we have to understand it may not be possible for some of us to read all these 700 or whatever the number of presentations. That is why we discuss about a strategy to do this. Now, our group, group number 3, with Kira as our facilitator, we addressed this issue, and what we said was, Campbell has already done a great job, and he has given some kind of sorting here. For an example, 318 MMPs and 15 MMP linked and so on, 107 PR online and 7 PR linked and so on. So I think that's the first step. And what our group suggested was to get little more help from Campbell and Ken, to see whether further, sorting can be done to minimize the work the members have to put in trying to understand all the concepts and principles involved in this, all this presentation. For an example, in the 318 MMP online, I'm sure they all are talking about MMP, so there may be few that will envelop all those principles, concepts involved in the MMP. Or if not, come up with some kind of another summary saying, out in all these 313 MMPs, this is what they're talking about, and some kind of a summary. That would guide us in a tremendous way to reduce the hours that we need to spend in reading this presentation. So once you
that's the strategy we are looking for. And we suppose you said that Kamal may not have died, but then I'm sure you are there. And also the issue of, when I say you came, you are there.
And also, somebody raised the point, why should they read it and sort out and say these are the ones to read? This was debated, and then we finally agreed, yes, here we are going to depend on independent academics, experts on the subject. So I think we have been depending on you all this time, and you did a fantastic job, and we went through the education phase. Now, little more help we need from both of you. So work over the weekends and get this done. We will read what you finally to understand all the principles and concepts.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, RB. I had Harley next. Oh, the numbers are starting to pile up.
Was Craig next?
Okay, sorry, Craig and then Harley. Craig? Okay.
All right. Quickly here. One election thing message that I think was missed was the split elections. The half elected in 2 years, and there was variations of that. So quickly on that. I will say I sorely say that it is our responsibility to read all these submissions. I'll say that very quickly. We have 4 months to do it. And in our discussion group, you know, two of our members, their work obligations are overwhelming, and I respect that. But in our discussion group, we were working together already of how to solve issues. You know, I'm willing to help anybody. I'll give you a list of submissions. I know there's many of us online that have read through them, many already. We can condense this down and help you out. But I really think it is our obligation, and it's important. It's to our credibility of, if we don't counter what the public has done, I just don't know where we're going.
Craig.
Can you hear me? Okay. I like to play the devil's advocate here, but I consider the public or the online submissions to be the same thing as the public hearings, and they need to be treated the same way. We are relying on other Citizens Assembly members to give us the top 10 presentations that people saw all over British Columbia with the 50 meetings. I see no reason why we can't treat the online submissions the same way.
Bob? 12? Nope. Okay. Mo? At 36?
Maybe I'm being naive when I got involved, but in the course of the 4 meetings that I attended, it seems like there was a concerted effort on one particular group to force an opinion upon myself, and I find that objectionable. I'm not a rookie in terms of political arenas. I've been around the bush and I can sniff something. But what I found, I haven't gotten the real people of BC to come forward, because I felt I was cheated in this process in terms of, with the repetitiveness and the same catchphrases, I think I was denied the opportunity for a lot of people to come forward and give me a good cross-section, a good diversity of what they expect BC. Because I still believe in this system, and more importantly, since this inception, no one has made a point of me to change my opinion. Why should we change our current electoral system? And the proof of the pudding, I may go back, many of you can remember, maybe 2 months ago, the largest democracy in the world, almost 600 million, that's right, 600 million people cast their votes. And you know what? A dark horse by the name of Sonia Gandhi, who was born in Italy, everyone had written off as an also-ran. The Gandhi dynasty had died. And lo and behold, she came and she won a clear majority with first past the post. I'm saying, before we run to the gates, opening the floodgates of change, look hard and look fast. That's all. Thank you.
I know that there's 160 of us, and we all have different time commitments, different time constraints, job constraints, family, etc. But I was under the impression that July and August was our reading time.
Exactly. I've got some more things to give you to read tomorrow. David on three.
That were made at the public hearings, which are being considered, which applied for the presentation of the plenary session, and there are 50 other presentations that were recommended by members. So it's 82 presentations, some of which have related submissions on the website. If someone could prepare a list of what those submissions might be, we've already considered them worthy of consideration for a plenary session. That might be a good list to start with if we're going to look at the submissions. And that might be something we could do fairly simply.
Thanks, David. And the last one we had on the list was Wendy, and she's on number 9.
I guess all I was going to say was I thought that we should use a discussion forum and start up a site there to talk about submissions that we're particularly interested in. I don't see why we all couldn't submit numbers of submissions that we thought were particularly interesting and worthwhile to read. I don't quite know how all of us can read all of them, but at least if we had a select list of numbers that were good to read, then that would give us all a starting place.
Thanks, Wendy. I think we're a bit over time, so I'm going to cut it off, but we have more time. Let me just try a kind of very quick sort of straw votey kind of thing. Campbell has suggested that we set a deadline. He suggested the 13th of August, Friday the 13th, as a deadline not for receiving them, but as a deadline for saying anything after this, we can't guarantee it'll be amalgamated into an index and a summary statement, because we have to kind of set some kind of date if we're going to prepare that kind of document. What kind of support is there for that kind of idea? Just hold up your cards if you think it seems like a reasonable, workable, sensible solution. Anyone who doesn't think it's a good idea? Anyone who wants to filibuster? Then why don't we set then Friday the 13th as that date? We will continue to receive submissions and we'll put them on the web as possible and they'll be available to members, but that we have to really kind of close the date and we'll announce it tonight, starting on the website or tomorrow, that anything received up till then will be part of the more comprehensive materials summarized and indexed. Things after that, we just can't guarantee it. Okay, thanks very much. I know Jack wants to make one or two points, and then we're going to move on. So thank you.
No, my point is Leo, and Leo is now taking over, but while Leo is getting ready, I do remind you, tomorrow, 7:15 for breakfast, 8:30 here.
I know when I met with that Prince George group in the concourse, and they suggested we should try to do something about providing some information about the rest of BC, particularly the people who don't get out to much of the province, but particularly people from the Lower Mainland. I volunteered to do something. I do those things from time to time, and then you wonder, why do you do these things? It was a bit of a challenge because there's so much to say in any one community. I found a document on the government website in BC Stats, a study that was completed in 2003. It lists approximately 63 communities. I thought, well, I'll try to distill that, bring that down to around 10 or 12. And before too long, I had the list up to 20 or 23. And I knew that that was too much. I also wanted to kind of browse along on the internet and find some nice pictures of every community. Unfortunately, the quality of pictures varies widely across. And if I was going to put them on the PowerPoint presentation, I would lose too much resolution because they're fine to look at if they're 2x2, and that's 2 inches by 2 inches. But once you put them on a PowerPoint presentation, you lose a lot of the resolution. So what I've done instead is just tried to capture some of the elements about about the communities around the province, and I've dropped it down. I think I'm going to talk about 10 or 11. But I got to get this right here. Okay. So what I want to do is just provide a bit of an overview, talk about some of the attractions that the BC Tourist Site mentions for these communities, probably give you a little bit of a feel for the population growth and percentage change for the communities. And when we get into that graph, particularly the change graph, not only do I have the community, but a couple of other communities and the region that that community finds itself in, so that you can see that it's just not that one place that is changing in terms of its population size. The BC Stats study that I found talked about the key income sources for communities. For 63 communities in the province, and possibly some of you might be interested in going and finding that particular study on the website, because it provides a lot of interesting things. It kind of gave me a different perspective on some issues, which I hope to be able to share with you. And then some key economic dependencies. Again, that study produced some sense of some dependencies that communities face as they go along. So what I tried to do was kind of flow east along the American border or the Canadian border with the states, and then flow up the Kootenays and into the Okanagan and then back into the northeast and then over to the northwest, and thought we'd end up here in Prince George. So the first community is Princeton. And some of the things that you can do in Princeton include several historical museums and sites. They claim to have good fishing. Gold panning tours. That was the only community, the ones I looked at, that had gold panning tours. Dog sledding, for some of you who may be interested in the winter sport. And, of course, hiking, biking, cross-country skiing, and that's up in the Manning Park area. Canoeing and kayaking is also something that they profess to have available in Princeton. The population growth, this is what's happening in Princeton from the 96 to the 2001 census. And the percentage change, whoops, this is going too fast for me, I guess I'll use this. Population growth, did I miss the percentage change? Oh, I know. It'll come up because I have them lumped together with other communities. So the population growth, it gives you some sense of decline in the Princeton area. These are the top four income sources for Princeton, as I found in that study. You'll find that in Princeton, one of the exceptions, where forestry happens to be the largest income source, and these are based on the wages that people earn in that sector. Then the next one is transfer payments. Transfer payments includes things like employment insurance, old age security, not Canada pension, but old age security. Welfare falls under that. The next one is public sector, and that's public institutions, government, hospitals, municipalities, regional districts, and so on. Other non-employment is things like pension, investments, and so on that come into a community. So you can see that the last three are all outside sources. Kelowna, some of the things that I found there were sailing, houseboating, kayaking, windsurfing, fishing, skiing, boarding, significant tourist attractions, heritage parks are common, vineyard tours, and these are common in some parts. I put down Ogopogo. It's part of the marketing strategy, and of course, Okanagan University College. Population growth, this is one of the exceptions in terms of patterns, where there's significant growth taking place in Kelowna. The four top four income sources, and this is reflective of a lot of communities that we're going to look at, but the first one is the public sector. The second one is transfer payments. The other one is other non-employment. And other employment, which is infrastructure within the community, where you're selling goods within the community, so the retail sector and so on would be part of the other employment. Nelson professes a lot in the arts and cultural resources, golfing, hiking, mountain biking, fishing, boating,
skiing, boarding, cross-country skiing, and so on, snowmobiling, and their post-secondary institution, Selkirk College. Population growth in Nelson, for those of you who were there, I don't know if they talked about this, but it's declining. And population change now for some of the communities we looked at. We have the Central Kootenai, which includes the Nelson region, and then the community of Castlegar, Creston, Nelson, and Trail. So all of those are declining in terms of population. Top four income sources for Nelson, we have public sector, transfer payments, other unemployment, and other employments. It's the same as I think I showed you for Kelowna. Cranbrook, and I needed to add one here after talking with Alan yesterday, Wildlife Museum, they have a demonstration for us in that area. They're close to the Fort Steele Heritage Park, golfing, skiing, cross-country, fishing, College of the Rockies, and there's a major destination casino resort now that's opened up not too far from Cranbrook. Population, one of the few areas where it is enjoying some growth. Top four income sources, and this is the Cranbrook-Kimberley area. Again, public sector, transfer payments, other, non-employment, and forestry. So it's one area where forestry shows up. Revelstoke, moving up the Kootenays. Galleries, museums, and theaters, curling, skiing, heli skiing, golfing, fishing, boating. Very close. They claim to have two national parks in their backyard. Hiking and bird watching are some of the activities that you can pursue. Population growth, declining. Income sources, you have public sector, transfer payments, tourism, and forestry. So those two latter ones are larger. I should have had them reversed so you could see them all in the opposite direction. But anyway, it's one of the few areas where you have something besides public sector and transfer payments driving the economy. Population growth for Revelstoke is declining. I'm going backwards here. Kamloops, again, a lot of the same kinds of things, but there are every now and again you have something like rafting, river rafting in the Wells Great Park, which is north of Kamloops. A lot of cultural and heritage facilities, fishing, hiking, mountain biking, golfing, horse riding. One of the few places that talks about horse riding, but there's a fair amount of that going on in the Kootenays. In the Caribou. Skiing, boarding, and of course the University College, Caribou University College is a major center there. I'll get this right yet. Population growth for Kamloops is on the rise. Population change in the central Okanagan, Kelowna, and this includes Kamloops, you'll find that a lot of the places in the Okanagan-Thompson area are doing well. But Princeton is, as you showed you the last time, is declining in terms of its population. Top four income sources for Kamloops, public sector. When you have a university college in the community, it tends to drive, and they probably have a fairly large regional hospital service, and so those things tend to drive the numbers. Transfer payments, other non-employment, and then forestry plays a part in that economy. Williams Lake Stampede, and I think it's the first July 1st weekend, so that's coming up for those of you who might want to stick around for that. Satchel Heritage Village, First Nations Village, Scout Island Nature Park, which is close to the city, fishing, river rafting, and again skiing, cross-country skiing, snowmobiling, and again another place that does provide you with a dog sledding. I think there's about three or four places that I ran across with that. Population growth, though, moving in the wrong direction. It's declining. Population growth for some of the communities in the Caribou. You have Caribou, generally the district, and then you have Quesnel and Williams Lake. What's going on here? That should be in the opposite direction. I guess I should have put a negative in front of that. Top four income sources for Williams Lake, again, public sector transfer payments are pretty large. Other unemployment, and again, forestry is a fairly significant driver of the economy in Williams Lake. Dawson Creek, mile zero on the Alaska Highway, which is a milepost location. Galleries and museums, skiing, cross-country skiing, snowmobiling, fishing, canoeing. They have a pioneer village, and then Northern Lights College is a major institution. Population growth, again, declining. Four income sources. You have public sector transfer payments, forestry, and mining. And mining includes petroleum resources. Fort Nelson, I skipped Port St. John, Heritage Museum, and they claim to have BC's most northern streetlight. They also are fairly close to the lowest point on the Alaska Highway, which I understand is about 1,000 feet. They do dog slagging, which you would expect, backpacking, trail riding, and again, canoeing, kayaking, and fishing. Population growth. Now, remember, this is 2001 and not 2004, so the boom in the oil industry may have changed that number, which I understand it probably is different than what it shows here. But in 2001, it showed a decline from 96. And again, the population change. Fort St. John seems to have the largest increase in terms of population, but the other communities have a decline. The four top income sources for Fort Nelson: public sector, forestry, mining, and tourism. So the public sector and transfer payments doesn't play a very large part in Fort Nelson. For Prince Rupert, they didn't have much on the website in terms of things to do. I'm sure there's more, but wildlife viewing, hiking, kayaking, sailing, sport fishing. Population growth, declining. Top four income sources includes the public sector, transfer payments, forestry, and fishing. And there's a couple of other places along the coast where fishing is predominant in their economy. Smithers, we have galleries, museums, wilderness museum, and hiking, biking, snowmobiling, skiing, and so on. Glacier viewing, one of the only places I notice with go out and take a look at a glacier. Fishing, community forest in the Smithers area, and of course another native village in Hazleton. Population growth, we have decline taking place in Smithers. Population change generally in the coast, North Coast region is on the decline in most communities, where you have Buckley Nechako, which is the regional district, and then Prince Rupert, Smithers, and Vanderhoof, all showing declines. Top four income sources for Smithers and Houston: you have public sector transfer, you've got forestry, which is sizable, and other non-employment. And I think that Smithers had one of the highest forestry drivers, and these are percentage figures. Prince George, and most of you have seen these, I suppose, in the last day and a half. Railway and forest museums. They do have a native art gallery. Llama backpacking, and this was the only place in that I ran across in BC with llama backpacking. Again, skiing and heli skiing, snowboarding, dog sledding, fishing. Every Thursday night, there's something called the BC Old Time Fiddlers Group meet somewhere in Prince George. 7 o'clock. University of Northern BC, which is a major facility, and again, a college in New Caledonia. Population growth for Prince George, I found this a bit surprising, but it's declining. It may be increasing now. Population change in the north central part of the province, and these all show the areas are declining in terms of population. Top income sources for Prince George, you have public sector transfer payments, other non-employment, and then forestry. I was really taken by all of these public sector and transfer payments and its impact. So I did a couple of charts, and I added those two elements together to show you the portion of the economy that it plays in those communities, so that you have Hazleton, a small community where it's over well over 50%. Nelson, Creston, Penticton, where it's just slightly above 50%. And then you have Nelson, Kitimat, Terrace, Prince Rupert, and so on, around the 50% mark, and then others are getting down into the 40%. And this is not just a phenomenon of the interior communities. I decided to take a look at some other communities that I haven't talked about. And, of course, most of you would expect that Victoria would be high, but in the Sauk area. We have Nanaimo, which is the yellow bar, Courtney Comox, Alert Bay, Chilliwack,
in Kent Harrison. Just to give you an idea, and I selected communities where this was the highest, but it's it indicates that the public sector and transfer payments plays a pretty significant role in a lot of communities in the province. This is a map of BC that tries to tell you where the dominant income source in this in the province, and so that you have the public sector is in some of these areas in here. And then you have, you know, mining oil. I found this surprise. I thought it would be up in Fort Nelson, but it's... That, and again, this is 2001 data. The study was done in 2003. These ones here are on transfer payments, the light gray, which I found to be a bit surprising in terms of that. And forestry, clearly in the interior, and... So it's a major player in the interior of the province. And this one here, I think, is tourism and the Whistler area. The study that the BC Stats did also talked about dependency. So the darker colors here indicate that these regions are quite dependent on forestry. So the darker green indicates a high dependency on forestry, whereas the light-colored green would be lower or less dependency on forestry. And this region in here is kind of where you have the pine beetle problem taking place as well. So you know, if you look at softwood and what's happened since 2001 and add the pine beetle to that, there's a part of the region of the province that probably is facing some pretty serious times ahead. Dependence on underground resources, and again, the darker colors indicate those parts of the province which have a dependency on underground resources, and that would be petroleum or could be mining and so on. So you've got the Fort St. John and north, and then Fort Nelson has a little bit in that area as well. This little pocket here is Trail, and that would be the Cominco smelter operation. And then this here is the East Kootenay area where they're doing a lot of coal mining. And Kitimat would be, I'm sure, the Alcan operation that's there. And areas that have a dependence on tourism, again, the darker blue, are those parts of the province that have a high dependence on tourism for their livelihood. They also did a bit of analysis on economic diversity, and so the darker colors indicate those regions that... are the least diversified, and the light colors are the most diversified. And Dawson Creek was one of the areas that came out being least diversified. And if you look at all 10 sectors that they provided in the study, they're not much different from the top to the lowest, and so they're all in a low percentage basis. So it comes out with a fairly good reading in terms of being diversified, whereas other communities have very low diversification. If they have a very high forestry factor, such as Smithers, which was in here. So Smithers is least diversified because it's very dependent on something like forestry. This is to give you an indication of how vulnerable certain communities are to the forestry. And again, the dark red indicates those parts of the province that are very vulnerable to any kind of change in the forest sector, so that if the softwood lumber deal is settled, then that would improve. If the pine beetle faces a tough winter, then things might improve in that part of the province. Again, this is just a summary to give you a bit of a sense of how things change from the 96 data to the 2001 data. And you can see that some places, like Dawson Creek area in here, is not dependent on the mining and oil and gas. And I think they closed down the Tumbler Ridge operation some time ago, and so that would change that aspect of it. So, and you'll notice that there's been an increase in the number of gray spots which deal with transfer payments from the 96 to the 2001. So all of these were put into your package this morning. At least they tell me that these slides are there, and the last two slides just kind of give you a little bit of flavor for the You didn't get it. Oh, they missed. Well, you'll have it on your desk tomorrow morning so you can take it home. And you just, if you're interested in the study, just go to the BC government website and find BC Stats, and it's on there. It's on the first page or the home page for BC Stats. There's lots of interesting information in there. I don't know if there's any questions. It's 5:15, and that was my allotted time to complete, so on target.
Thank you very much, Leo.